Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6:30 to 7 with authors, agents, and poets talking about anything and everything having to do with writing. Tonight my guest is the very lovely and brilliant Noreen Ayres. Noreen is author of two novels, A World the Color of Salt and Carcass Trade, both published by William Morrow. She's published short stories and poems. Her volume of poetry is called Sorting Out Darkness. Noreen's a former Orange County writer now living in Houston, and I've known her for many, many years, and she's a dear friend. Are you there, Noreen?
Hello, Barbara.
Hi.
Good evening, everyone.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Noreen, your entree to publishing is one of the most outrageously wonderful stories of anyone I know. Will you tell everyone how it happened?
Yes, it is. It's a true Cinderella story. I got discovered, just like Lana Turner. Well, or so it seems, but there had been a lot of groundwork set before that. I was discovered at a writer's conference, Squaw Valley Writer's Conference in Northern California. And I had gone there with part of a novel that I didn't think anyone would really take seriously because it was a workshop after all. That's the way they run their conference. And I didn't expect that anyone would pay much attention because it was an unfinished novel. But from that conference, I acquired my agent, who is my agent still today, and an editor who was interested, who eventually did buy the book, and a movie producer who did not option my book. But anyway, it was a very exciting time.
And so your first book came out in 92.
Yes.
Yeah, A World the Color of Salt. Talk about how exactly it happened. You had 30 pages?
Yes, the way that the conference is run is they ask you to submit 30 pages of fiction as an application, almost, to attend the conference. Those 30 pages, or if you choose some other work, will be critiqued in a workshop that is led by one of the staff members. And so the workshop may have 10 or 12 students or participants, as they call it. And I was very lucky to have an extremely discriminating editor leading my workshop. And he called me aside and said, gee, when you're ready, when you're finished, I would like to take a look at this. This was independent of the agent that I had selected to look at my work also. Squaw Valley Writers Conference gives you an opportunity to have a 20-minute session with someone who is visiting at that time, who could be a member of their regular staff every year or could be just visiting that particular year. And it was an agent from the William Morris Agency. And we connected, and he liked the work, and so we were thrilled with each other.
And then what?
And
then he said, okay, send me more.
Actually, I had written 100 pages, but I only had brought 30 pages to the conference. And so I went home and mailed him those 100 pages. He presented them to the editor who was interested as part of an auction. So actually, he sent the pages out to five or six people, and the price that I asked for kind of drove up, and it got into the six figures, and I selected the one who originally had shown interest, who was an editor at William Morrow.
It's so unusual. I mean, it's so incredibly unusual for an offer to creep up into the six figures. How did that happen? I mean, it sounds like in part you made that happen.
Well, sometimes naivete works in your favor. I was aware of what usual advances are, which sometimes don't even come up to $10,000. But I thought that I should ask for a year or two salary of what I was making at the present time, at the current time, because that's how long I figured it would take me to finish the book, do revisions, support myself while I write a start on the next one. And so I boldly just gave 2 years' salary as a figure, and then my agent gulped and said, okay, I'll go see what I can do. And he's magic man.
Yes.
And I don't know how it happened, frankly. It was like a bolt of lightning.
Will you read from that book?
I'd love to. Love to. This is, again, from A World the Color of Salt, which is a crime novel. And this is chapter one, and it is a page, a printed page, and two-thirds.
Okay.
All right. First they shot him in the mouth. His tongue split down the middle like a barbecued hot dog. That was from the .22. Of course, we didn't know that until the autopsy. Usually with stop and robs, it's a quick hand me the money, no I won't, boom, and it's done. But there was something different here, because first they shot Jerry Dwyer in the mouth, and then they went back for a bigger gun. What was it Jerry did or said that made him that made them so vicious? The boy was a cool head, would have laughed it off if he could, would have thought, because he was trained to, give them the frigging money, let them book, then call Dad, who knows all about that insurance stuff. Go on to the party and find some way to make the story funny. But Jerry Dwyer wasn't going to the party that night or any other night. They say about cops that there are cops' eyes and your eyes. I could say the same about this work, too. I'm a criminalist, job title forensic specialist for the Orange County, California Sheriff Coroner's Office. I work out of the crime lab in Santa Ana, about an hour's drive from L.A. What I do is collect, protect, analyze, and store evidence. A copper can have a guy cold, dead bang, as they say, and miss out sending the dirtbag to the Gray Bar Hotel if the evidence is not rightly collected, analyzed, and secured, and we at the lab help him and the DA do it. I've been doing this work for more than 5 years, seven if you count cop work in Oakland. Friends call me Smokey. I'm female, 5'5", bland blonde, the right weight. And I was pretty untouchable before this. I could do babies and not cry. But this case got to me. The blasts of blood. The hopeless trail to the back of the store where Jerry Dwyer ran to get away from his killers. The awful skid marks, like experiments in new paint. Before the murder, I would stop at Dwyer's quick stop on the way home from work and grab a coffee and a donut, and with a couple of turns, be on the freeway heading for the lab. He was a big kid, Jerry was, 20 years old, 219, 6'1", blonde blue. He worked in his father's store 2 hours in the morning, then attended Saddleback College for computer classes till noon, and returned to the store afterward to work some more until his evening auto shop class. How could you help but like a kid who worked like that? Here in Orange County, it's real easy for kids to have a free ride, affluent even when they don't think so. Not Jerry. He knew, maybe from first eye on the world, that this wealth was an accident. While other people were counting on lottery tickets or their parents' various insurance policies, he'd say, "You gotta have a plan, man." He'd say yuppie scum were everywhere, building, buying, busting, and someday it was all going to come down, and they're going to be looking stupid at each other like they all wet their pants the same day. Now Jerry stretched out on a steel tray in the coroner's cooler, and my eyes tear up about 4 times a day. Joe London Sanders was investigative team leader this time, and in better hands we could not have been. Team leaders are rotated. I'd been off having one of those surgeries you don't like to talk about. But before that, I'd led most of the investigations for several months. Things had already begun to change for me. At 32, the fire shouldn't have been out, but the number of crimes was increasing almost exponentially, it seemed, and I admit the work does get to you. You go in wanting to fight the good fight, wanting to make a tiny ripple of difference. Before long, you think everything counts the same, all murders are equal, everyone has to die sometime. Then a Jerry Dwyer wakes you up.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you've just tuned in, you just heard Noreen Ayers read from the opening of A World, The Color of Salt. This is Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and of course I'm talking with Noreen Ayers. You have a wonderful voice. Is it something you've had to work at? Or has it always been this way?
Are you talking about the voice on the page?
Yeah. I'm talking about this, just the whole point of view, the voice of the book.
I think that, I came into this world pretty stupid and still think I am a lot of the time. So I have to hearken back to the gradual education that we all get as creative artists. And a lot of that just seeps in through osmosis. I don't know how I learned to have a voice, and I hope I continue to have it on the page. And what is it anyway? I tell people that I think voice is simply that when you pick up a book, it sounds like somebody's talking to you across a coffee table.
Yes, somebody unique, somebody who sounds like themselves.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I will quote a writer, Richard Ford, whom I greatly admire and who attended UCI, as a matter of fact. I think of this little quote from him many times when I need inspiration at the computer, and it is simply this. He says, "Say the unsayable." To me, that's the secret of voice. It's the secret of writing that inspires others to want to write.
Mm-hmm.
You have to tell secrets. You have to say things that you reach down into your core for. Things about yourself and about humanity that maybe we don't want exposed.
Mm-hmm. This wasn't the first book you wrote. You wrote another novel that you tried marketing that you ended up putting away.
Yes.
Do you think that book had this voice, but for some reason the plot wasn't working? Or what do you think was wrong with that book? Because then you did so very well with this one.
I think that it was not voice. I think voice or style was developed through many years of writing poetry. But I think it was plotting. And I'm still not a very good storyteller, to my lights and some other editors' observations. But that doesn't throw me too much in the long run, because I know many readers don't read just for story. They read to get involved and to know those secrets that might be whispered to them off the page.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how A World the Color of Salt began. We were talking about this earlier today, about first lines.
Yes.
You had the first line to that book, and you knew it would become a book. Will you talk a bit about that?
Yes, I was taking an introduction to forensics that was offered at UCI for the first time, taught by the former director of the Orange County Crime Lab. And I thought, gee, if I'm going to write a crime novel, I guess I'd better learn something about crime. And in that very first session, he gave a number of anecdotes, war stories from his experience. And in this particular story that he told, probably not more than 20 or 30 seconds, he came up with that metaphor about a victim being shot in the mouth, and it was split down the middle like a barbecued hot dog. He was an artist in his own right. I mean, he had seen this, and that was the impression that he had. Now, he went on and he told a lot of other stories over the course, but that one was so gripping to me that on the way home, it came back, and I knew that that was going to be a book, and that book would sell. How did I know that? I think it was because of the disturbance that it elicited in me. And then the voice was already there.
Hmm. That's interesting. Is that a normal occurrence? Do you get first lines first?
I start many fiction pieces with either lines of dialogue that come to me or just phrases that almost are independent of anything. And so I don't mind the idea that, in a way, this was given to me
mm-hmm.
through conversation, because an artist gleans from it from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
A writer gathers everywhere, and sometimes you know and sometimes you don't know where it came from. This one I just happen to be able to identify.
I recall you saying you had either a file of first lines or a notebook with a section of First Lines.
Yes, I do have that, but also there was a wonderful book published by Chronicle Books out of San Francisco called In the Beginning.
Hmm.
The subtitle is Great First Lines from Your Favorite Books. And I've got three of them if I can read to
yes,
you.
Yes, definitely.
And I was a real believer in first lines anyway. We used to go to Costco and turn open all the books there on the table and just read the first line.
Hmm.
And, for instance, I remember Ken Follett in Key to Rebecca had one that went like this. The last camel collapsed at noon. And then I heard that he had another one. I can't give you the book it's from, but it was The Three Boys Came Early to the Hanging. Now, see, that starts late in the story. Hollywood always tells you, if you're writing a screenplay, start as late as you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's already a story behind those two lines. How about this one? Elmer Gantry was drunk. Of course, you already know that's from Elmer Gantry, Sinclair Lewis. But it's that sucker punch that mm-hmm. wakes people up, you know. And I like that. Let's see if I can find another one real quickly. How about this? Mr. Deck, are you my stinking daddy? A youthful female furious voice said into the phone. That's Larry McMurtry from uh-huh. Some Can Whistle.
Uh-huh.
I mean, just irresistible moments that break the frozen lake within us, you know, mm-hmm. wake us up.
You also said earlier when we were talking about collaborating that when you just mentioned screenplays, I thought about that because most people, well, maybe not most people, but screenplays are a natural for collaborating. You said that collaborating is a way to keep going. Can you elaborate on that?
I think that writing is one of the harder arts because it's done in such solitude. Yes, practicing a musical instrument is done in solitude, and many of the other arts are too, but perhaps for not as long before you get any public feedback. And so it's really hard to keep going. We don't get a paycheck at the end of the week to know if we're still employed, you know. So I think that if we can find anything that will goad us or inspire us or keep us hanging in there, you know, we're very lucky. One of the things that I think might do it is to have someone write with you, someone just as interested as you, but finding finding that fit is truly a fortunate thing if you can do it.
We have a few more minutes, and this is actually the last week of my show on a half-hour format. Next week we go to an hour, so it'll be more leisurely, but I'm trying to get all this stuff in. And you're also a poet, a wonderful poet, and I know you have a new poem. Will you read it to us?
Yes. This is, also I should say, a way to keep going is to have minor victories. And in the back of Poets and Writers magazine, there are all these classifieds, and occasionally I'll read them and I'll say, well, gee, there's something I might be able to send in for. It's not going to take 4 months of my time. And so I did. Someone had an appeal for poems about frogs and toads, and that just struck me as hilarious, and so I wrote me a poem. The book came out. It's absolutely gorgeous, color cover, back and front. It's really beautiful. It's called Of Frogs and Toads, and it is edited by Jill Carpenter, who is herself a biologist, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
forgive me, Jill, if I get that wrong. Anyway, this poem is called Elvis on a Lily Pad. Bellowing basso profundo, pleased to be bombastic best, choose me, he teased, above the rest. The wink of knowing promise, the sly come-hither grin, the king is in his palace, let every maiden in. Green girls wide-eyed with wonder emerge from khaki goo to marvel at the thunder and rock the pond anew. Stadium skies and fireflies, a spotlight moon, he's set to croon. Wet algae tresses quake with stresses. A fling of flirty burps his answer charmingly with chirps until, for Elvis Minasaurus, the ladies swell a fervid chorus that sets the slimy water steaming beneath their hot and fevered dreaming. No wonder that such skilled gyrations beget, and soon, fresh froggy nations. So it's kind of a silly little thing, but it was fun.
Yeah, where do poems come from? I mean, this is a silly, wonderful poem, and you have very solemn, very emotional poems, and they sort of run the gamut. Where do they come from for you?
Most poems come from agony. That's why this is so different for me. But again, sometimes it's just a phrase or a moment, a visual moment, something that strikes us. One time I saw a maggot-laden snake upon my garage floor, and it was, you know, really repulsive. That became a poem.
Hmm.
Or a cat sauntering under a hollyhock at dusk. And of course, you have to shape that poem, shape that moment, and have it be a little story with a beginning, middle, and end.
Mm-hmm. Noreen, we're at the end. Do you have advice, words of wisdom?
Oh, my goodness.
Pearls you'd like to leave, other than the wonderful pearls you've
got. I think that writers, and I call everybody writers whoever wants to write or has written, not separating writers from authors. I think we're both tough and tender and arrogant and afraid, and as long as it's satisfying in some way, we must keep going, because it's a great way to communicate and to reach out to others and to find self-expression. So get on the phone and get a writing buddy and keep on keeping on.
Yeah. Well, it's been great to have you.
Thank you very much.
And maybe you could come back in a couple of months when we have an hour to chat.
I'd love to. Thanks for asking me.
You're welcome. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Noreen Ayer's books, A World the Color of Salt and Carcass Trade, are available on the Internet at bookstores that you'll find there. And again, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The music you heard at the beginning and that you'll hear at the end of the show is blues and jazz guitarist Brian Barrett. If you have any comments about Writers on Writing, please email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. Chris is on next with On Air, Off Air. If you know of someone who would like to listen to my show or any show here on KUCI, you can listen on the Internet at www.kuci.org. In January, again, starting next week, actually, my show will be running from 6 to 7, so tune in. It should be fun. Take care, and thank you for listening. If you're on the road tomorrow night, please be careful, and please pay attention. Now get to work. Remember, it's all about writing, like there's no tomorrow.